starting, you know, in our case, on the state system, starting with the text, and then looking to other sources as necessary, then you're not going to get as much of the personal preferences in there. And honestly, you know, one of the things, one of my favorite quotes from Justice Scalia is, if you're getting the outcomes in cases that you agree with all the time, you're doing this job wrong. Because it's really not about what our personal preferences are. When we're dealing with statutory interpretation, we're trying to figure out what the legislative branch meant and the executive branch in signing off on that statute and how it applies to a particular case. So, you know, certainly we do have some discretion, and not every case is going to be clear about how the statutes apply, but the rules and the canons do impose some discipline and some constraints that we're required to follow. I'll just give you a couple of examples of the kinds of cases that where this has come up in my court in the last few years. We had one case that where there's a Texas statute that says it deals with a situation where if you're married to someone and you put them as the beneficiary on, say, your 401k or your life insurance, and then you get divorced and you forget to cancel that and you die, does that person then inherit whatever that asset is?
I have that case right now.
You do? Well, you can read my opinion. So the situation, the legislature enacted this statute to say the divorce cancels those designations because a lot of people just forget to check all those different places that you can designate a beneficiary. So we had a case where a man and a woman were engaged to be married, but they weren't married yet. And so he made her the beneficiary on his retirement account. They did end up getting married and then later got divorced. And so the question was, does the statute apply to that situation? And we said, no, it doesn't apply because it says that you have to be married at the time that the designation is made. And so, you know, while it might be a good policy to extend it to engaged couples, that's not what the legislature had chosen to do. And so if they wanted to amend the statute, they could do that. So that's one example of a real-life statute. Another one, this was a federal statute, and the question was whether forum selection clauses are void under the Jones Act, which...
I have that case, too.
Okay. See, there's a lot of issues that come up in common in federal and state courts. And so we had a long time, the Jones Act incorporates laws regulating recovery for personal injury to railway employees, which is code for the Federal Employers Liability Act, FELA, that deals with railroad employee liability. And there's a venue statute in FELA that says, it talks about where an action may be brought, and the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted that to cancel out any foreign selection clause that's inconsistent with that. Now, we can debate whether that's a reading of the plain text of the statute, but that's what they've said, is that this provision that says an action may be brought by a plaintiff in certain forums means that you can't contract that away, basically. And so the question is, does that apply to the Jones Act, which used to have its own venue statute, but then it was repealed? And so the question is, does the general federal venue statute control, which wouldn't preempt a foreign selection clause, or do you import this FELA venue provision that's been interpreted to cancel a foreign selection clause? And we said, venue is not a law regulating recovery for personal injury to a railway employee, because venue doesn't regulate recovery, it just tells you where you can bring the suit. And so we said, no, you don't import the venue provision from FELA into the Jones Act, because if you focus on those words, regulating recovery, which strangely no other court that had interpreted this provision had really focused on those two words, that you don't import this venue provision. So those are just a couple of recent examples from both courts, I guess, where these issues, you know, where you have to parse the language carefully and there are problems of interpretation. One question that has come up in the state system from time to time, we have something called a Code Construction Act, where the legislature has basically told us how they want us to interpret their statutes. And we've been asked, is that okay? And my answer is, why not? They're the ones that wrote the statutes in the first place, and so it seems natural that they can tell the courts and the public how they want their own handiwork to be interpreted. And basically, it's a list of statutory construction aids. It doesn't purport to be mandatory or exclusive, and it doesn't give priority to one source over another. So it's pretty easy to fit in with the rest of what the Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals have said in this area. I'll just mention a couple of last topics, and then I want to turn it over to Judge Rosenthal. It's important to think about, as I indicated earlier, what type of document you're interpreting. Constitutional interpretation obviously has a lot of rules that are unique to that area. The idea of originalism, for example, the idea that stare decisis has less force in the constitutional area because it's so hard to amend the Constitution. And also, it's important to think about the difference between a federal constitution and our state constitution. Any of you have ever seen the Texas Constitution, I'm sure nobody in this room has read the whole thing because it's several volumes long. It's much more like a statute than the federal Constitution.
Like a bad statute.
Yeah, exactly. well put. They have tried to change it without success, so we're still operating under the 1876 Constitution. We just keep amending it. But, you know, I think it's an open question whether the fact that it's so different from the federal Constitution and is amended so frequently affects the way that we interpret it. That hasn't been developed much in the cases yet, but I can certainly see an argument for that. And the last thing I wanted to address is, as future lawyers, how should you present interpretive arguments in cases that come to us? And, you know, I think it's important to start with what the courts say is their preferred method of interpretation in the jurisdiction where you are, for the particular judge that you're in front of. Obviously start with the text if that's their preference, but also you want to explore the context of the statute, the structure, similar provisions, harmonizing them so that nothing is rendered superfluous, looking at the common law because there are rules about statutes and derogation of the common law, and that's an area we don't, some people sometimes forget to say, well, what's the common law in this area that the statute may or may not be displacing, and we need to read it in light of that. Look at cases, obviously, and trends. But don't only look there, especially if the cases aren't binding. It's helpful to us to hear, you know, what is the impact or the difference or the consequence of one interpretation over another, and to talk more about why your result is correct as you're advocating, not just this is what some other court has said. And use the canons to help you. Look at the Code Construction Act for ideas of different sources you could look at. To help you. If you think legislative history is going to be helpful, I'd encourage you to look at it. Maybe not as the starting point in a court like ours where our high courts have viewed it with some skepticism. But if it's helpful, put it in there. There may be some judges that will want to look at that. And as the case that we asked you all to look at Judge Rosenthal's suggestion, shows the Digital Realty case, you know, there's still very much a division in the U.S. Supreme Court about the utility of legislative history. And I think, it's not an all or nothing thing. There are definitely reasons to be skeptical of legislative history because sometimes it's written by participants favoring a particular result and it's not tempered by compromise the way the language of the statute is. And so it needs to be viewed with some skepticism, but that's not to say that it never has any utility. And so it's useful to argue that as one among many sources of meaning if there's ambiguity and if it supports your client's interpretation. And I'm going to stop there and turn it over to Chief Judge Rosenthal.
Thank you, Brett. And thank faculty and all of you for joining us this morning. This really is our first rite of spring. Brett and I know what it is when the flowers are blooming, and we're at the University of Houston Law Center talking about statutory interpretation, spring has arrived. And I understand that we are about the last thing that stands between you and spring break. So I wish all of you a very happy and safe spring break. I was reminded of how fraud it is out there by several cases I had this week, which draw on the jurisprudence of mishaps on spring break. There's a whole body of case law out there. Why do I raise it this morning? Because a lot of it deals with interpreting legal texts. Some of those texts are statutes. Some of those texts are contract between somebody who goes on spring break and signs up for a zip line tour or a bungee jumping adventure. Sounded like a bad idea at the time, and it was. Or somebody has a contract with a hotel or with a cruise, otherwise known as the fine print on the back of the ticket. Or it is subject to treaties governing international travel. Or it is subject to statutes governing liability, governing venue, where you put a file the case that deals with the accident in Mexico involving the not as smart as he or she thought she or she was, a law student from the University of Houston who decided to relax and have an adventure. Long story short, this is a statutory interpretation class, but we're really talking about a broader range of interpretive skills and interpretive techniques, legal texts. And the issues in figuring out the meaning of words on a page has been part of what has occupied the study of law and the practice of law from the outset. What we're doing, it doesn't get any more fundamental than that. Not only for law, but for much of human activity. What do we mean when we say something? Do we mean what we say? Do we say what we mean? And Brett is absolutely right when he cites recent cases. This is not abstract stuff. You do this every day, whether you know it or not. You interpret what people say to you. You interpret what you read on the page or on a computer. You do this now. What this class importantly does for you is make you think about what you are doing so that you can discipline it. You can make it transparent. You can communicate what it is you are doing to others and why it is the right approach. You can make it a form of advocacy, which is what you as lawyers will be tasked with doing. So, Brett is right. This comes up every day and every week. I wrote the bail opinions in this case. Over and over, I was faced with looking at what do these words mean in the state statutes that govern what state hearing officers and judges do in determining bail for individual misdemeanor arrests. What does the state statute allow? What does it require? What does it forbid? All those things needed to be answered. The judges wrote their own rules. What do they mean? Do I interpret rules of court in the same way, of procedural rules, not substantive standards? Do I interpret them the same way I interpret a state statute governing the substantive standards? There are hard questions. And what do I do if those documents conflict? What do I do if the law itself is unclear? So that once I have figured out what those statutes mean, what those rules mean, then I have to figure out what the law is, what the constitutional provisions governing themselves mean in this context. Three different kinds of documents, all of them needing to be interpreted. So Brett is absolutely right. No one quarrels with the first step being, what are the words? And is there a shared and clear understanding of what those words mean so we can inventory them? Well, we operate in an adversary system. I've got plaintiff saying, it means this. I've got defendant saying, it means that. And I may have other parties saying, pox on both their houses. It means something entirely different. Does the fact that people disagree amount to ambiguity, which means that I can start looking at other sources to amplify my understanding of the meaning of the words. If I can't resolve that question based just on the words used themselves and the punctuation that gives the words their meaning. No. We know that the fact that people do disagree isn't enough. But if the disagreement is entirely reasonable, that is, if you read the words and they could reasonably be read to mean either or both, what the plaintiff says, what the defendant says, or what all the other voices say, or some of the other voices say, then I have ambiguity. That's the test of ambiguity. Can they reasonably be read to mean more than one thing? The answer to that is yes, and I have to pick. What am I going to turn to pick? But if it is a contract, and a contract can be a letter, it can be written on the back of a napkin, it can be what people said to each other, it can be an insurance policy, it can be what you promised the zip line operator you would never do, like sewage. It can be any number of exchanges in many forms. But if I say it's ambiguous, I get to talk to the people who were involved about what they intended when they entered into that exchange. Do I do that with a statute? If I can't tell what they mean, do I then call the legislators as witnesses? What if it's a very old statute? Well, obviously that would be difficult. But what if it's a new statute? What do I do? Subpoena the members of the Texas legislature? Subpoena members of Congress? Does Congress have an intent the same way an individual who buys a house or enters into a contract has an intent? We don't think so. We don't think so, even though they are both actors. So what do we do when we are trying to figure out a public entity's intent and it is not clearly written? Well, here it very much does depend on your school of thought and the type of statute you are construing. So Brett quite properly points to the Constitution, and it is unique. There's a wonderful line from the Supreme Court opinion that is almost poetic. Let us not forget it is a constitution we are interpreting. There is something different about the constitution. Because Brett is right, state constitutions, many of them, ours among them, look a whole lot more like Octopus horrible statutes, badly drafted over a course of years, than they do with constitutions. Drafted by people who were really quite amazing politicians, patriots, and lawyers. They were gifted, and if you read, as I love to, some of the accounts of the Constitutional Convention, the drafts of the Founding Fathers, you will be in awe of what they created. And you can say, perhaps so. But what do you do when the words, which are framed to be quite gentle, quite broad, because they are intended to endure and cover a country that they could not foresee would grow and change. Doesn't make sense. What do you do when you take the language of an amendment, say the Fourth Amendment governing searches and seizures, that was drafted centuries ago, and apply it to this? And this. What do you do when you are looking at technology that lets the government and private actors know everything about you? And you are complicit, right? How many of you buy on Amazon? Okay, who doesn't? How many of you are on social media? Well, let's ask it. How many aren't? A couple. I'm probably not. Well, I'm a stalker. You've given it up. So what do we do? What do we do? That was Constitution. Our Constitution. We have precedent. But that precedent, much of it, was written before we had any of this stuff. And P.S., we're foolish if we think we understand where technology has put us, because it's changing right now. And my only prediction for the next 10 years is that artificial intelligence will change every aspect of this conversation. In ways we cannot prevent. So what do I do? Do I, as this book urges, look at the original intent of the universe? Is that sensitive, one must ask, when that intent was formed in the context of the day? When words were words on paper, and that was all. When you kept things private, quite easily. It was different. So what do you do with that? Do you just say, well, I'm going to try to figure out what Thomas Jefferson would have thought? Or do you do what this book says? This is written by Robert Katzman, who is currently the chief judge of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. As you can tell, it's a slender review, but it is brilliant. These books are both brilliant, and these are the bookends of the debate. This is what you read about in this opinion. These bookends, I recommend these books to you. You can dip into this and dip out of it, and you'll get the idea. But you'll also get a lot of comfort and your own arguments. Cashman's book is equally eloquent and very simple. So here is the textualist approach. Look at the words and try to figure out what the people who wrote those words meant. Original meaning. Cashman, the so-called purposive as opposed to textualist or original meaning approach. Purpose. You look at what the document was intended to achieve, and you use that understanding, the answer to that question, to apply the words which do not themselves give you their meaning clearly. To apply the words to the specific facts before you. Whether it is applying the Fourth Amendment to this, which the Supreme Court has before it this term, and will be one of the most consequential decisions of this term. Or whether it is a statute that was written to govern railway workers in a much different time. or that was written Jones Act to cover seamen, when vessels were very different from what vessels look like now, and the notion of stationary huge rigs that look a whole lot more like land than they do ships wasn't part of the landscape. So do you look at, when Brett talks about being consistent, can a judge sitting back in his or her armchair say, well, I'm going to always be a textualist, or I'm going to always be a more pragmatic purpose of this in my approach to legal texts, particularly statutes? And Brett, I don't know if you and I agree here. As a trial court judge, as opposed to an appellate court judge, I find it easier to be a little more pragmatic, because I'm only biting the parties in front of me. And yes, it's important that the parties have some ability to predict what I'm going to do, but precedent gives me that. And the type of document I'm looking at is going to inform the approach I take. I think we agree there. But Brett may think it more important as an appellate court judge to be clearer on his method, and clearer that it is the method that will be followed across a range of cases, than I, as a trial court judge, may think it necessary to do. So there's another variable, not just the type of document and the type of issue, but the type of court deciding. And you guys in law school read mostly Supreme Court cases. Their mission is a lot different than my mission. In some ways it's the same. And the legal standards and the law we apply is the same. But they are binding the country. And they have the ability to overrule themselves and to overrule the Supreme Court if they think it appropriate. I don't have that ability. And it matters. It matters. And just last week, I got reversed in a case in which the Fifth Circuit overturned itself and banked. When in bank overturned itself in a case that involved how you read a horrible statute called ERISA. It's a nightmare. But it matters to the outcome of the case. And I was bound by the Fifth Circuit law. I knew if he wrote this opinion, which I thought sucked. But that was the law. Sent it up thinking, well, I'm good to go. I'll never see them again. And the Fifth Circuit says, well, 27 years of precedent, I don't care. Do it over. Fine. Tax you do. I'm not the Supreme Court. Fine. The outcome. But you see the difference that the court itself can make. So back to my question. If you can't figure out the words of a statute or a city ordinance, what the legislature intended, the enacting body, the city council, what do you do? Well, you look at legislative history. My view is that, yes, you do consider the source, and that affects the weight you give it. But I don't believe that it is provoked in all circumstances. Do you appropriately look at it? This is the question raised by Digital Realty. Do you appropriately look at it if it's clear without looking at it, just from the words you use? And that case was interesting because that case involved a seemingly simple exercise of statutory interpretation. Does the whistleblower protection apply under Sarbanes-Oxley or Dodd-Frank, which are written differently? This was an issue of Dodd-Frank, two statutes governing attempting to stamp out fraud in companies. Does it apply to a whistleblower for complaining internally within the company or to a newspaper, but not to the SEC. The court said, well, the statute says complain to the commission. You got to complain to the SEC. Simple and distorted. Entire court agreed. There had been a circuit split. Two appellate courts had said, oh no, it clearly covers people before they complain to the SEC. Because that's the purpose of the statute. Look at the legislative history. Look at Judge Katzmann's report. And up at the Supreme Court, they say, no. They agreed with the Fifth Circuit, which, by the way, had been a minority in saying, you've got to limit it to what the statute says. But the court divides. They agree on everything. It's only concurrences. Court says, the majority says, well, I'm going to look at legislative history, even though I know the answer without that. So in a sense, it's dicta. But they look at the legislative history for a narrow purpose. It's like a cross check. Let's just make sure that the way we are reading the plain language is consistent with what we understand from the legislative history is the purpose of the statute. And they wind up coming. It is. They are taken to task by the concurrences, written separately, one saying great and one saying no. And it's not a bad point, which is that at least it's unnecessary. But the concurrence, of course, goes further and says, which won't. You just shouldn't go there. Not only do you not need to, it just doesn't make sense. It's not sufficiently reliable. But think about that. I mean, you're absolutely right, Brett. The legislative history, the committee reports, they're often written by the people who have an agenda and a particular point of view. And I'll give you a perfect example. There's a statute called the Class Action Fairness Act. There's a whole business of naming statutes to make them sound better than they are, right? Class Action Fairness Act. Its purpose was to get class actions that cross state lines out of individual state courts and put them only in federal court, okay? It was written by, and for 9 years pushed ultimately to success by the Chamber of Commerce and pro-business, pro-defendant groups, entirely. And the lawyer who wrote the statute wrote the committee report, wrote the legislative history. And he did a great job. It couldn't be clearer. Clearly had an agenda. But it was what the statute did. Does the fact that it was a one-sided view, which was the view of the statute, make it unreliable as a guide to what Congress intended when it passed the statute? It may, in fact, make it the most reliable guide. Because it's written by the people who wrote the words of the statute themselves. It's an interesting question. How do you deal with the tension inherent in that interested, prevailing party view? These questions come up all the time. And they highlight the other thing that thinking about interpreting text should make you even more keenly aware of, the importance of legal writing. Of clear writing, starting with the premise that there is no such thing as legal writing. It is only writing, good writing. It's not jargon. It's not lardered up with all sorts of Latin or with unnecessary terms that were once characteristic of the discourse of which nobody uses or should use anymore. Any of you ever write the word whereas?
You should be ashamed.
Clear writing. It can be technical. Sometimes it must be. But if you do not pay attention to writing clearly to convey what you mean, you will be putting your clients through the contracts you write, the releases you craft if you do litigation, every legal document you write, including letters, engagement letters, at risk. At risk of being embroiled in these disputes that fog out things. So read the books that expose the ambiguities and risks inherent in writing. And there are some wonderful ones. One of my favorites is called Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. Depending on where you put the commas, the meaning changes entirely. Right? You're either a panda bear eating a bamboo, or you eat, comma, you shoot, comma, and you leave. Often matters. So what you ought to take out of your class on statutory interpretation is the techniques that you can use and describe to support the conclusion you draw as to the meaning that best serves your client's purposes and needs. But you should also take away the tools of good writing that lead to that result. How many of you want to be IP lawyers? Patents. I'm looking right at you. Patents are the most god-awful pieces of drafting anybody in the Congress ever put their minds to. And we're talking millions of dollars. Patent construction. I spend a lot of time in there. And it's fascinating. But the lawyer who has to go back and explain this to her client, you lost this invention, you lost these royalties, you lost the ability to have a monopoly here because I screwed up. You don't want to do that. So all of you, spend as much time on legal writing as you can during your time in law school. Take the classes that make you write. And go to the people who can help you by giving you feedback, not just on the substance and content of your work, but on your writing itself. You have a resource here. Use it. Because it won't be available to you out in the law firm, or out in the agency, or out in the court, wherever it is you end up working. You won't have the support. So use it like you got it. Because it is the single most important skill you will take out of all. The ability to read and the ability to write. I've been on the bench for 26 years, and every day I take a class in legal reading and legal writing. So it doesn't matter that I don't have these great resources. Mark it up for you. That's my soapbox. Right, any questions, comments?
All right. Well, first of all, thank you for a great. And now we have an opportunity that you will rarely have to ask questions of judges where you're not behind a podium being cross-examined, perhaps.
And so, we are in a road-free zone.
Yes. Before I start, I just want to ask my fellow professor, Professor Dennis, Professor Bush, if y'all have any questions you want to start off things.
I have many, but I think it's better to let the students have this
opportunity. Okay, then. With that, I am looking for volunteers.
You got one right there.
This question is directed to both of you, Your Honors. Thank you for coming to this meeting. I was curious if you could talk about the dynamics of the fear or lack thereof of having a decision being overturned in a higher court, whether or not that plays into your thinking. I'm not saying on an explicit level, but I would assume that even the most self-confident person to some degree has a little bit of a boost in their ego when a higher court overturns a decision that you render.
Does it show?
Sure. So the question is, to what extent does it factor into our thinking that we might be reversed in a particular case, and how does that affect our decision making? Just to summarize, and I'm bound to follow what the higher courts have said in particular cases, and so I'm always thinking about that. But I think in a particular case. I'm looking at the precedents for guidance, but I don't think you can sort of make your entire or the focus of your decision, how would the Supreme Court decide this case, or how would the circuit decide this case? Judge Rosenthal agrees with me, and we'll see what her thoughts are. But because you've got to take those precedents and apply them to the case before you, and if you spend a bunch of time sort of wringing your hands about, they might view this differently, we got a lot of cases on our docket, and so you don't have the time to do that, even if you wanted to, and I don't really think it's good judging. You take their precedents that you've got to follow, and you apply them to the case before you, and you move on. And sure, is it disappointing when you get reversed? Yeah, sometimes it is. Sometimes they change the law, and you have happened to me recently as well, and then, what's to feel bad about? You were following the precedent that was there before.
They just admitted that they had been wrong.
Right. Exactly. So, that happens, but, if you spend all your time keeping score, you're not really focused on reaching the right decision in case it's before you.
Justice Scalia, when he was on the court, was the justice assigned to the Fifth Circuit. So each of the justices had their own circuit that they were sort of the chief guy in charge of, and they would, it had substantive duties, so if there was an emergency motion to stay an execution, for example, that came out of the Fifth Circuit, he'd be the guy to rule on it. But he would come to our annual conference, and he would give an award to the district judge who got reversed by the circuit court and then got the circuit court reversed by the Supreme Court, and the district judge vindicated by the highest court of the land. So that is my, we all fantasize. But how much does that fantasy affect my day-to-day? And I think Brett's right. To the extent you will fear reversal and therefore try really hard to get right the identification of what the precedent is, what it means, and how it applies to these facts. You really want to be right because you really don't want to be reversed for being wrong on those points. That, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's simply respect for precedent. But there's the second category of cases that we deal with where I know what the precedent is and it really doesn't help. Doesn't answer the question. Or there's a majority rule and a minority rule and they both have some good points. And the Fifth Circuit hasn't spoken directly. Or these are really hard questions. They're not definitively answered in a binding way that applies clearly here. And reasonable minds can and do differently. Okay, so there, am I going to be up nights thinking, well, let me see, the Fifth Circuit, given the new appointees, is more conservative, and it's likely to go one way, because here's, and depending on whatever panel gets it, it may go this way, and no, I don't think. If reasonable reasonable minds can and do differ. And a panel of the Fifth Circuit looks at what I did and says, you know, I don't think so. I'm okay. But what I never want to have happen is Fifth Circuit looking at it and saying, well, actually, the judge said the record said X. In fact, the record says Y. And that changes the outcome. I never want that to happen. So I don't want to be wrong on the facts. I don't want to be wrong on the law. But in the many gray areas, if they want to substitute a different shade of gray, they have that right. I may not be persuaded, but I will be bound.
All right. Yes.
Thank you for being here. This past summer, the Court of Criminal Appeals ruled in a case that the Texas deadly weapons provision and the penal code didn't apply to multiple cases because of ambiguity in the statute. And to reach that conclusion, they relied upon legislative silence in the legislative history and the committee reports, only concerning findings of deadly weapons against humans as opposed to animals and no reference to animals at all. Do you find that reading that silence into the legislative history is still an effective statutory interpretation tool today, or is that something complicated to the court to identify?
Again, if I could ask you to briefly repeat the question.
Sure. So if there's one approach to legislative history that looks at what was said in maybe prior drafts of the statute or in committee reports. And then there's the approach that says, well, they didn't mention that, and therefore it can't be covered. You know, I find that troubling, because it assumes a role for the legislature or a capability on the part of the legislative body that may be overstated, which is that they are going to itemize and specifically mention everything that the text is meant to cover. Now, it may be that that is absolutely warranted. If there is a list and it is meant to be exclusive, sure. But how do you tell if the list is exclusive or an indication of the types of things, but not an exhaustive list of things it is meant to cover? Well, there are some words that communicate that. Includes maybe one of them to describe what you're covering, as opposed to are, or comprises, or consists of. Those might be cues. But those are pretty subtle cues, and they assume a level of precision that may be unwarranted. So in answer to your question, I find that troubling. And let me put that in the context of another debate that is now going on in the circuit courts. There were decisions yesterday in one circuit, and I think 2 weeks ago in another circuit, following yet another circuit that weighed in a couple months ago. And it said that Title VII applied to same-sex discrimination. So that if you have a transgender individual, and that person is the subject of adverse employment actions, that is actionable. Okay? It's not merely sexual harassment because someone is male or female, whatever. And this, I guarantee the legislature was silent on that. Does that mean that it's not going to be covered? That's the question. And that takes you back to the problem of the statutes that were written some years ago. There may be lots of things they didn't mention because they didn't exist at the time. Now, animals obviously exist. But what do you do? You can't carry the principle of silence to a written principle of interpretation, I don't think.
And I just add, and this is another difference between the federal and the state system, state legislative history is pretty limited. And it certainly hasn't been the tradition heretofore that the legislature has to list out everything that the statute's going to comply with in the legislative history, because there's just so little of it to begin with. So, you know, I think I would have to go and look at the text of the statute, but it does seem like, you know, if you're going to be focusing on the words and what they communicate, then to be thinking about, well, did the legislature intend for an exception to be made to that because it's not listed in the legislative history, even if the words, you know, sort of plainly cover that circumstance, you know, I think that may come as a surprise to the legislature. Let's see what they do with it. It's the Court of Criminal Appeals, so I'm going to follow it.
All right. So wonderful questions here, and lots of hands going up. I'm very appreciative. I'll finish up over here and work my way back over here, I promise. So.
Hello. My name is Diego Haddad. Thank you so much for coming today. I guess my question is that in our class, we've been taught that judges and courts are faithful agents of the legislature and do their best to interpret the statutes. However, at the same time, while reading cases and the history of certain cases, it seems at times that judges will have a certain policy in mind and attempt to interpret the statute in order to forward that policy. So I was wondering, through your experience as judges on both the state and federal levels, how often is it that you see perhaps a judge would try to forward what they believe is a correct policy person?
I'm not going to say it doesn't happen. You know, I think that the old case that I was mentioning earlier, the Federal Employers Liability Act case, where the Supreme Court interpreted a venue statute saying where a plaintiff may file a case to mean that the plaintiff can't contract away his right and enter into the form selection clause, and the words just don't say that. So you have to get that purpose from somewhere else, and it wasn't from a legislative history. You know, so I'm not going to say it doesn't happen, but I think, you know, for people who take their oaths seriously, that is our job, is to be an agent of the legislature and to decide what their intent was, and that, you know, the approach, I think, is even, you know, folks on all different parts of the sort of jurisprudential spectrum agree that the text is the best indication of that. Justice Kagan saying we're all textualists now, I think, is a real tribute to the dialogue that's gone on in this area over the last 20, 30 years. And so, you know, that's why I think it's important to have a consistent approach to these cases so that it doesn't vary, you know, on a case-by-case basis. And that's not to say that different factors won't have more or less importance in a particular case, and I certainly agree with Judge Rosenthal that, you know, we also need to keep in mind what the practical effect of a construction is going to be. But I do think that if the courts, you know, the high courts that are setting the tone for how this gets done, put out that these are the steps you need to follow, and this is the way, you know, if it's not ambiguous, don't use the legislative history to create an ambiguity. There's, you know, just one example. If courts follow that consistently, then you're much less likely to get those sorts of outcomes where it's just a policy preference.
I agree with Brett, and I would just note that it can sometimes be difficult to cut through the reaction to a decision to understand what his real basis was in terms of text. And just recently we've seen this with the opinions that during the Obama administration struck down DACA, and during the Trump administration have prevented him from not enforcing DACA, requiring to enforce it. So we have politically opposed judicial acts, both of them weighing in on the constitutionality or the permissibility of certain executive orders, And both of them being characterized by different points on the political spectrum as judges' individual policy preferences trumping, no pun intended, what the president with the executive authority intended. Is that right? Well, they were interpreting the text, those judges, in these different results. But ever since Marbury versus Madison, we have known that judges have the ability and the obligation, power and duty, to review legislative enactments, figure out what they mean, under the law. And as long as we seriously undertake that obligation, we will from time to time expose ourselves to the charge that we are wanting the legislator in service of our own policy preferences. I think that is less often true than not.
And we have time for maybe one or two more questions. So saw several hands going up. And I'm actually, also since it's the International Day of the Woman, I want to make sure that there are any, I was being diverse in my calls as well. Any? There you go. Thank you very much.
You rise for all women.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rosenthal, and good morning, Justice Busby. I'm so sorry. It actually has a lot to do with the question that I'm about to ask you. How do you balance following the rules of decorum within the legal field with delivering a truly just result for every single person that comes into your court?
You mean, how do I know when to stop talking?
No, of course not.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question. In the sense that every judge, and I don't care what level, is sort of walking a fine line between being authoritarian and being a very patient listener. So I must give, and Brett must give, every part of me, his or her or its full day in court. But what does that mean? Does that mean they get to ramble on? Well, Brett says, what, 20-minute time limits on each side. I don't do that, but I do have a lot of constraints on the amount of time that I have available. But if someone is representing themselves, happens to break me. Or if someone is not unrepresented, but underrepresented, meaning their lawyer sucks, at what point do I say, shut up because you're not saying anything? If someone is out of line, what do I do? I had in court this morning a young woman, 5 children, who had committed and pleaded guilty to marriage fraud. That is, she had taken money for entering into a sham marriage with a non-citizen so that that person could remain in this country. Totally a sham marriage. And she pleaded guilty. I let her on bond. And while she was on bond, she took herself, contrary to all orders, on a little vacation to Mexico and took selfies of herself in the process, so it was pretty easy to prove. And this morning at her sentencing, I was harsh. Because I was offended by not only what she had done, but because she was in my court saying, have pity on me. I'm a single mother with 5 children. I have no money. And here she had done this entirely selfish act. Left the kids, spent the money, right? So I was harsh. And as I walked out, I gave her a merciful sentence. I really did. I did not sentence her essentially at times. So I gave her a break at the end of the day. But as I walked out, I asked myself just the question we just posed. Was I too harsh? Did I abuse the bench and make it a bully pulpit? And I often ask myself that question. When I talk to lawyers, I interrupt them. I tell them they've said enough. I tell them they're... Sometimes I would try to be polite and say, I'm persuasive. They all know what I mean. Am I too harsh? Am I too authoritarian? And yet I have to control the court. I have to husband the resource that a judge is to make sure that all of the cases get the attention that each case deserves. And it's a balance. Every day in every case, it's a balance. But it is a great question because it's part of the art of judging. And Brett does it too. When has he got the opinion right? When has he done it? He can spend another 2 days on it. And he's got a whole bunch in the queue. When have you given each party its day?
And you have to be sure that you're fairly addressing all the arguments that are right. And I think...
No matter how...
No matter how stupid, that's a why to finish that thought. We have time for one last very brief question, but we have to expect that to be out by 11:45.
One of the really interesting things about this class is how much legal interpretation has changed. I know we say we're all textualists now, but I'm wondering what do you think drives this kind of changes, and what do you think will change about interpretation 10, 20, 30 years after?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I know what will change. I think, lawyers, I think the law has become an increasingly technical craft and an increasingly specialized craft. I count myself very fortunate to be among one of the few real generalists that are left in the law. I do everything. But I think as the law has become more technical and specialized, there's a lot of appeal to sort of the systematizing your approach to interpretation of legal texts of all kinds. And so, without having sort of research specifically on the point that you've raised, I would hazard a guess that it probably the focus on textualism probably arises from that. Desire to have a more systematic approach to that area and more grammatical and textual approach. So that would be my guess, but I don't have any predictions about how things might change.
I don't either, but here's an interesting case study that points to both the change in the methods and the change in the outcome. And that's the interpretation of the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution, the right to bear arms. Is it limited to a well-regulated militia for generations? That is the prevailing understanding. That's what we were taught. So I was taught when I was in law school. And that's what historians believe. And that's what constitutional and legal scholars believe as a matter of interpretation. And then it changed. That's not how we apply the Second Amendment today. It's not how the Supreme Court has told us we should read those words. It is a general right to bear arms. It is not limited to a well-regulated militia. Well, what happened? Look at that, because that's sort of the best case study I know of that indicates both a change in the method of looking at the law, text of the law, the words of the law, and the result was to dramatically change the outcome. So that's a question to answer your question. But it is a really good question.
And if you figure out the answer, please let all of us know.
But I will actually, one final point. So here's a great example. Contracts. We have to interpret. How do you interpret a contract when a contract consists of clicking a box on a computer? How many of you read before you click? Okay? Anybody? At least you're an honest group. Nobody reads. Does that change the way we interpret what people are obligated to do under what they have clicked their consent to signify? Stay tuned, because I don't know the answer to the question. Neither do I promise.
And with that, please join me in thanking our speakers today. Thank you for great questions and participation, and most importantly, have a great spring break.
Make sure you didn't.